Hello, everybody. Welcome to the End of Seeking podcast. We're at episode 28.
Yes, that we are.
And so let's start off with some announcements. Let's see if we've got, what have you got happening for you right now?
Right now, I'm in the middle of my month of light, which is until the 11th of March, the new moon, meeting every single day on Zoom for a transmission meditation at 8 p.m. UK time. And on Sundays, an hour before that, we meet for satsang at 7 p.m. UK time.
Nice. I've got, for myself, I have a series of satsangs coming up Saturdays in March, starting this Saturday. They'll be at 5 p.m. UK time. I've called it the Spiritual Foundations series. Each week, I will look at a different... what I consider to be a foundational spiritual lens or approach. Each week will be a bit different. So one week will be self-inquiry, one week prayer, transmission, stuff like that. This week, Saturday, it will be meditation. So if you have any interest in that, I mean, it's satsang. It's all satsang. The whole purpose of it is to, discover and explore and abide as our true self, but I'll be using these lenses to jump off of approach. This week's Saturday is meditation. So 5 p.m. Saturdays, UK time.
Where can they find that?
Oh, okay. Find out. You can go to my website, which is martinweber.com/events. I'll spell that out because it's the Welsh Martin. martinweber.com/events. Or go to endofseeking.com and there's a link to my website there.
Very good.
Yeah. Everyone welcome.
Very good. All right. So this week we often before the podcast starts, we discuss, is there anything lively for either of us or both of us? Mm. And I think we were discussing this notion of, why is it that so many who awaken to their nature end up sharing or teaching or being a light of that in the world?
Yeah.
What is it about that that brings about that impulse? Not for everyone, but for many people.
Yeah. I mean, why not just... I mean, and many people do just carry on their life as usual. I mean, I know plenty of people who don't teach from this place. But there's a lot that do. We were sort of wondering what are some of the motivations or principles? Mm-hmm. What's happening there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's many. We had quite a lengthy discussion about this. I think it was a couple of weeks ago now, but it's been.
It's been.
No, I've got to go further back than that.
Oh, yeah? We had a conversation about this recently.
Yeah, we had a conversation about this recently, and there's many facets, I think, to this as to what is the motivation. And we could pull on many threads of that, and we'll try to do that here today a little bit. But certainly one facet of that in my own experience, and I've seen in your experience, and I've seen in many people who I've worked with as well, is that quite naturally there is sort of this flow of wisdom that starts to emanate. There's where there's clarity there, and it doesn't necessarily happen immediately, but there does seem to be as clarity sort of dawns further and further. And that's often impacted by the integration process and sort of the peeling away of conditionings and delusions of nature of existence. But as that clarity sort of comes about, the veils start to peel away, let's say, or become more see-through. I think the wisdom starts to shine through in that clarity. And that emanation of that wisdom, I think, is just a natural byproduct of that clarity. It's like you become almost this vessel or this channel of life flowing in that manner. That's one thing I've observed, is quite naturally that process seems to take over, whether someone feels inclined to share or not. But I think where there's an emanation, it's sort of hard not to in some ways. I noticed this of myself very strongly. I didn't have much to say about all of this beforehand. And
I remember, you know, when we were, I was a seeker for a very long time, and it became very real for you, and you start, you know, we were both seeking, and then you have this breakthrough, the shift of awareness, the shift of identity.
Yeah.
But you would never talk to me about, you know, I was like enthusiastically kind of exploring and talking, and you know, it was very hard to get you to engage on it. We just weren't interested. And then suddenly, you know, in the wake of like an awakening, you started to, we both did, to be fair, but you, it was more prominent because you had never really talked about this subject or this
it's like the words
anymore.
Were just suddenly there, and it was like a tap had been turned on. These words, these insights, and they weren't mine. They
in
were just,
speech and in writing and in all sorts.
I still to this day, I wouldn't even say they're mine. You know, I wouldn't. I couldn't possibly put that.
Claim it as a personal thing.
Yeah, it's just that's why the word emanation for me is a really beautiful one there, because it's an outpouring. It's like it's a tap that gets sort of turned on sometimes to lesser and more extents, obviously. But
it's there, isn't it? It's like a wisdom emanation. It's really quite interesting to see.
Yeah.
You know, I have some view on it. I just took a note here that why for me, like why this from in my own experience as a seeker, and then as I say, let's say a finder, is that, you know, for while you're a seeker, often you're so preoccupied with your own suffering. I was so preoccupied with my own, trying to get to the root of reality and the nature of suffering, the nature of, you know, the nature of the self. And that was my driving force in life for a couple of decades. It was just that was it. Like, I need to get to the bottom of this. And of course, there'd be some distractions along the way. And, you know, my spiritual path is a curly, windy one. But ultimately, there's that kind of one-pointed focus on let's get to the bottom of my liberation, because I'm suffering to whatever degree. And liberation, awakening is the, you know, to root that out.
I think it reminds me of in our conversation we were having, you know, this phrase came to me, and I don't know what, if it's out there already. I don't know where this phrase came from, or it's just another emanation of wisdom. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but the phrase came of the two turnings.
Yeah, well, right, yes.
That phrase, and we've talked about this over the years even, of these movements. So when, you know, you just take someone ordinary off the street, not particularly interested in spiritual awakening or anything like that, you know, their focus is a very outward looking focus into the objects of perception, into the objects of the world. It's very worldly. It's very material, some could say.
Yeah.
And that it's a very outward looking focus. Yeah.
But they're lost to their own nature, their own source, their own ground. It's so outward looking that they're oblivious to their own.
Yeah, and so what happens is the spiritual path gets seated in the heart, gets planted, the seed gets planted in the heart, and it's like the first turning. So you're turning inward towards the looking, rather than outward, starts to turn inward. It's an inward turning, it's inward facing. And so suddenly the search becomes that inward search, which is what you were speaking about just there. That sort of, it's in some could say, is a very self-centered search.
Oh, it's entirely big self-centered.
Yeah, big self. Yeah, exactly. But it's about the individual. It's about the individual suffering often as well.
Yeah.
It's like, well, who am I? What am I suffering? What's the nature of myself?
What's true? What's real? What's,
exactly. But it's a very inward looking. It is, suddenly, and actually as that search becomes more fever pitch, let's say, it becomes more one-pointed, it becomes even less outward looking, it becomes you know, you start to not be attending so much. It's not that you rejecting life, it's that your attention, your focus becomes one-pointed. And that one pointed has a direction, and that direction is inward.
Yeah.
It's inward facing. And then, so those shifts come about, that recognition, those abiding recognitions of who and what you are, and that recognition of I am that, that mm-hmm. which I'm seeking, I am that. And there comes the second turning, the second movement turn. Mm. And that is a turn outward again.
Only this time you're seated in the ground, in your own yeah. nature as awareness.
And actually this time that there is no inner and outer as such. It is the seated as awareness, mm. as the self. There is a permutation of, is that the right word? You just gave me a bit. I don't know if that is the right word.
It's an Emmy word.
Okay. Yeah. yeah. So what happens is the self starts to permeate into all of existence.
Yes.
And so all becomes the self. So all the outward looking, the movement, the flow of outward is actually the self moving outward. It's like an expansion. So it is not just me, individual, mind, body, me as the self, but actually everything as the self.
Like an expansion of inclusion.
Exactly.
Where otherness yeah. becomes,
yeah.
you know, consumed or included into the exactly. into the singular nature of yeah. the self. Yeah.
But in terms of direction, it looks yeah, outward.
Exactly.
But at that point, it's none of it is outward. All of it is an inner, outer looking.
Yeah, right.
So that's no. Just
It was a few years ago. I wrote a piece called "What I've Been Thinking About Recently," and it was actually about this process of I've been so one-pointed in my thing that I'd hadn't noticed, in this case I was talking about the culture and the politics, oh my God, I hadn't really paid much deep attention to the nature of the state of the world and the yeah. state of people's thinking and the culture and all that. And it was like I was an ostrich pulling my head out of and going, looking around going, oh shoot, I didn't even know any of this was going on.
Yeah.
And they pointed to that principle. Oh, it was because of that singular focus, and it's not universally true of all seekers,
no,
but it is actually quite is typical. I say that movement, the yeah. first movement inward, because you're just one pointed.
Yeah, and I think this speaks to why people teach, is because it's not about them teaching; it's about that outward looking. It's about everything being included in the recognition of the self.
Yeah.
And where everything is included, it's not just about my suffering, it's about suffering.
Yeah.
And where you see another suffering, where it's like the awakening process, to me at least, is one of the heart breaking open and the recognition of the love that we are. And in that recognition, where you see suffering, you see that it is not just me and mine, but it is, I am life itself. And if life itself is suffering in the form of another,
yeah.
There is work to be done there. There is something in which there can be an attentiveness towards that can be supportive of life. In the cessation of suffering.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Once you've and also this compassion, right? Further to that, the compassion that comes once you've in a great liberated sense come to, let's say, the end of suffering, even though you know difficulties and challenges can arise within sure. that, but really it's the end of that certain kind of mental overlay suffering that construes life in a particular way.
Yeah, and it's also the end of the resistance to life, which is fundamentally you are at war with life, and that is suffering.
Yeah. So, as you say, come into a state of ever unfolding peace with life.
Yeah.
It liberates your view, and you know, compassion, seeing someone, let's say, suffering from, you know, suffer, because we suffer so much from ideas, and the ideas are correlated with resistance then, and about the way, you know, there's an unpacking, an unfolding, an unveiling that needs to happen, that liberates us from these limiting, you know, views, that allows us to sort of live freely, as you say, in non-resistance and freedom. You know, having come to that, it's very it pangs on one's heart to see that happening in another.
Yeah, it does.
Now everyone is where they are, and everyone has, you know, you can't necessarily reach. But some people then come onto the, you know, come to this point where they go, oh, I need to get to the bottom of this. And, you know, the availability of someone who's already sort of trodden that path to come and help, to offer their...
I also think that there's... I think that you just hit on exactly the word that I was going to say of, like, the availability. I think something that I've also observed is you become more available because you're not so... there's a clearing out of your own inner striving, so to speak. And in that, it's like in that light of that silence, in light of that quietness that comes often, not, it can take time. It's not to say this can be an immediate thing, but there is a thinning out and a quietening down that tends to happen.
Yeah, for sure.
Even if it's over quite a long period of time for some people. But it's like you become more available, you become more present, you become less filtered. You like what I've noticed is, you know, you meet people exactly as they are without an overlay or a filter, parsing through your own suffering, parsing through your own personhood.
Noise.
Yeah. And so I think that is also plays a big part in it, is you literally become more available. I remember, this is a slight sidestep, but it's like, I remember that thing of like feeling like there was a lot of hours in the day suddenly.
Yeah.
And I know that's a very strange thing to say in the context of all of this, but it really, it's like you don't realize how much energy and time gets taken up with mentation and suffering of that mentation.
Wow.
And so for me, that was one of the sort of things that really was this interesting byproduct that no one would have ever been able to convince me of before.
Yeah, the length of the day, the sheer span of, and it's the openness, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like the preoccupy, if you've got nothing, not so much internal, you know,
dialogue
and activity. Suddenly there's the spaciousness of time.
Yeah, and then therefore the capacity to meet people.
Well, I think that's a great point, because when I look back at before and after, before, you know, and I think back to how I was, you know, running about my life, and I see so much about how I wasn't present.
Yeah.
Just wasn't present.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, and what, present to what? Well, mostly people.
Yeah.
And conversations, because you, like, if you're in a conversation with someone, as you said, you know, your mind is completely full of your own stuff.
Yeah.
So you're not able to really hear and be present and hold space for someone and you know, be even aware of their things, because it's all about you. And then that's just the nature of a egoic mind, you know.
And I would actually argue, going one step further than that, not contradicting it in any way, but going one step further, is that we're not even present to ourselves. We're present to our thoughts and our analysis and our mind and our judgments.
Yeah.
Sure, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, we're preoccupied by that. But actually, that's a way of avoiding being present to our own.
To what is, our true self, yeah.
And so not only are we not present to the other, we're not present to ourselves.
Yeah.
We're present to our thoughts, sure. We're present to our, you know, mental strategies and sufferings and thoughts and judgments and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're fundamentally not being present to ourselves.
Yeah, it's true.
And so I think that that's another aspect of that, is like, not only are we not being present to the other, we're not, because it's because we're not being present to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've noticed is the more you're able to be present to yourself and the depths in which you're able to meet yourself.
Yes.
You are then able to be present and meet the other in those depths. And I think that's what lends itself naturally to things like teaching, mentoring, guiding, sharing, all of whatever word you want to use there, but supporting people.
So it's an interesting thing, isn't it? The degree to which, and I've heard this said before, and we've talked about it, but also, you know, recently someone, you know, a teacher that I know of said it quite succinctly, but we'll say it the way I feel it. It's the degree to which you can meet yourself, as you say, is the degree to which you can meet the other.
Yeah.
That's a deep principle. But what's important is why is that important?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and what happens if, and sort of looking back to my own life and looking at how we operate as people, mm-hmm. when we have unmet depths, emotional and depths in ourselves, so that if someone is coming to us, or we're coming to someone with some something, and you're going to bump into the other's trauma around that. And mm-hmm. I say trauma in a very loose but open way, that there's places we don't want to go. Absolutely. In ourselves. And so there's no way that if we're with someone, that someone's going to be able to go to somewhere where we can't go ourselves.
Yeah, because everyone becomes a mirror.
You're
going to
bump into that. And people are bumping into themselves all the time, because there's places that you can go and places you can't. And you experience this bottoming out. You might be with someone, you're talking about your troubles. Now, whatever. And if you bump into something that activates them, in that they can't hold the space for you anymore, they can't be present to yours, mm-hmm. because they're not present to their own.
It
keeps us locked into this sort of trauma cycle in ourselves, this conditioned trauma cycle,
because fundamentally we become mirrors for each other. When you start to become in relation to another, they become a mirror of yours, and you become a mirror of theirs. And that's the nature of relating. That's the nature of consciousness appearing as two temporarily.
And here's the great value and benefit of being, you know, of discovering your groundless ground, is that you become bottomless.
Yeah.
You become fathomless.
Mm-hmm.
Or unfathomable.
Yes.
In the sense that, once you're that you can be present to the other, and they're not going to necessarily bump into anything. And if they do, then even that is held.
Exactly. That gets folded
in.
And that gets folded into
it as well. So this real power of being able to meet and be met.
Yeah.
And it's so in that fathomless, boundless nature that we are, there's space for everything, there's space for everyone. Yeah. We're not going to bump into each other so much and reinforce our already kind of broken natures, or already traumatized natures, or are deeply conditioned. So this is, as you say, becoming a teacher, quote teacher or guide. It's because you're available for that, as you said. Yeah, it's the presence is there.
Yeah,
and someone can safely kind of drop into and be felt, be held, be seen.
I think to me it seems like, because the question comes up here, but why is it like that way? And obviously no one can fully say why of anything. I think why is often a tricky question. But it seems to me, at least, that it's like life wants to always find the path of least resistance, like the river flows, if it hits against a boulder, it's going to go around the boulder. And so to me, this speaks to this. It's like the life finding, consciousness finding the path of least resistance. And what's the path of least resistance? One who is one that is awake to their nature, and therefore not in resistance to life, becomes this natural vessel, or the path of least resistance, by which the wisdom of life can be expressed and shared and met in all. And so it's like something akin to that. I was just feeling that. Why? Because it's the path of least resistance.
Yeah. well, then it's the path of no resistance. And, you know, there's a charm in that and being around that. I mean, that's what I was seeking out as a seeker. I was just that openness, that boundlessness, you know, you just sense it at a very deep level, and you know you can be held and expressed, and you're not going to bump into anything, none of this, you know, stuff. But, you know, but what is it that we bump into? And I think it's things like it's identity. Yeah. It's like we again, it's back to some of the sort of fundamental issues that the constitutes our sort of personhood and our suffering, therefore, is that we're holding on to identities because we are lost. You know, if you're lost to your true boundless nature, then you're doing your very best to hold on to, because we need to identify somewhere, something. And if your identity is focused on the body or the body mind or ideas and thoughts, you know, you can see these identities. And so this is what you bump into when you're with someone, you bump into these tightly held ideas. And, you know, there's a reason why people tightly hold on to identities. But holding on to these provisional identities and defending them, and
it's safe. It feels that you need to land somewhere.
You need to land. And that's the great, the great revelation is it's the groundlessness that is the ground.
Yeah, it's landing in the unlandable. It's landing in the groundless ground of being, where you recognize, I'm landing into this free fall, this broken openness, this awareness, this consciousness, this boundlessness that I am.
And there's nothing to defend.
No.
You know, so there's no proximal or provisional identity that you have to sort of hold on to and bolster egoically, because that's all you've got.
And yet you are, the paradox of all of that is as you are seated in that true recognition of the self, it's not an assertion of what you are. Mm. It's a recognition, a resting in what you are.
Yeah.
And in that, the capacity and the ability to be any identity is also met.
Well, but it's understood to be, these are provisional. Exactly. These aren't, you know, we're all looking for a sort of a lasting happiness, a lasting sense of existence. But our true existence is this boundless field of being itself. If you're not aware of it, if you're alienated from that, and most people are, you know, it's just the nature of who we are as humans, and where we are in life. If you're lost to that, then you're going to be seeking out some kind of, you know, something to hold on to. So I am this, I am that, not just simply I am.
Yeah.
And it's that I am this particular thing then. Now, all particular things are provisional. They're phenomenal. They're changing. They're impermanent. Mm-hmm. So that sense of, and so it speaks to the root of the suffering of the individual. It's sort of rooted in this existential fear.
Rightly so, actually, because it's...
Well, from that perspective, if you don't realize that you're boundless, timeless, eternal
exactly.
being.
Exactly. It's if there's a false sense of who and what you are, it's just the cracks of that beginning to show, and there's the rightly so bit.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not that that's truly who you are. It's that you exit that existential fear is it may be completely unconscious and precognizant, but this recognition of that I am not safe.
Yeah,
it's the person that I think I am is not true. And so, yes,
in an
it is not.
Sense, exactly.
Yeah, so, it's not permanent.
And, you know, there is so much freedom in this. You know, discovering that ground, that being knowing, like in the deeper sense of yourself, that, you know, I am that, thou art that, all this is that. The person, the body, it's fine to be enjoyed, to be experienced.
But just in the way that you enjoy a rose, the rose doesn't stick around all season. And so you enjoy that rose, you smell its fragrance, you experience its beauty, but you're not holding on to it as if it will always be that way. Mm. And you're not grieving it when it goes, because you recognize that its nature is always was always to go.
Yeah. Yeah, so... Yeah, so...
So, yeah. So why do people teach? And these are some of the things we've...
I think it's part... I mean, one... Yes, well, these are some of the reasons. And, you know, in a bit of a nutshell, it's because I think it's when you've undercut your own suffering, when you've discovered, oh, these were and are the causes, but I see through those. Mm-hmm. That whole layer of you know,
suffering not just,
kind of disappears.
Well, and not just seeing through it in a mental, and I know that's not mm-hmm. what you're speaking of, but just to clarify, mm-hmm. not just seeing through it in sure. a mental sense, but meeting it and feeling through it, seeing through it in a all layers of existence sense. And so it's like at that point where there's a meeting of the entirety of our experience, mm. this is where it dissolves back into nothingness. Mm. But you can't, it's like you have to go through it, not around it. And so to go through your suffering, you find the bottoming out of that is just the self. Mm. And you recognize experientially that the thing I was suffering was actually the separation of
the imposed sense of separation, exactly. but not actually a real disconnection between you and a seeming other.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I like, so one of the ideas that comes to mind in regard to this is the notion of the bodhisattva.
Mm.
And, you know, I see these traditions as really, you know, time-honored formulations about, and not sort of bodhisattva as a vow to take or an identity to live into, but a real description of what this process how this process of a way of let's say ignorance in its traditional sense, awakening, and then this upswelling then in the light of clarity, absolutely. The emergence of compassion, because of the transparency of the causes of suffering and your heart. You know, we all, it's a natural part of being human, mm-hmm. in whatever condition, is that to witness someone suffering touches our own heart.
It does.
You know, that's just this love, that's compassion. It's just naturally inspired in our own heart. And again, this availability in, you know, when kind of one's true nature is sort of found to be abiding, the presence to that upswelling of love and compassion, and therefore the desire to become available to help another, is a perfectly natural thing. And I think the idea of the bodhisattva points to that, and I think it points to it as I said, you know, as a seeker, you can be really preoccupied with one's own suffering, mm-hmm. and then pop, and then you're suddenly available to the suffering of others in a bigger way.
Yeah. I think you know, there's something that, as you're speaking, something that comes to mind for me is, not only are you available, but as there's the thinning out of the sense of doer, what starts to, I think, naturally upswell is not only are you available, but you're available in a particular way. You're available as in service to life.
Yeah.
So it's like, instead of my personal will of what I want to happen and what I want to do with life, that takes over this sort of universal sense of being in service to life, that life is flowing through you, that you are but a vessel of that, you are but a vehicle of life. And in that recognition, I think, like, certainly for me at least, I don't want to speak for everyone, but my experience of that is this real sense of your head is placed on the floor of life. This, your head and your heart, is like this sense of like, I give it all to life. Mm-hmm. And I think that, that's just a natural byproduct somehow of
this deep humility, yeah, isn't
exactly
it? In the light of reality, that's...
Yeah, where you start to see, God, this is not, none of this is my doing. I'm not in control of any of this. And what you start to feel is like, even this upswelling of love for life is not mine.
No, absolutely.
And this sense of care and tenderness and compassion towards the other is not mine.
And it's the gift and the grace of that.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And so,
arrogance goes out the window at that point in that sense, because, and I mean that, we mean this technically speaking,
yeah.
Arrogance is this conceit that I'm great at something, or I'm even doing it in the first place. It's sort of the humility
that
comes under the recognition, I'm not doing any of this. This is all just the upswelling
even the personal me, even the sense of Imogen here is but that too. And so in that, I feel like it's just life dancing at that point. It's life dancing. Okay, life is dancing in service in this way. And that service looks like teaching or mentoring or supporting or being just the simplicity of being present to. I remember I had this conversation with someone sort of on the lines of this a few weeks ago. And they themselves are being called to this way, this service. And we were talking a little bit about letting go of any leftover ideas of what that looks like. Letting go of even these grand ideas of serving a big purpose to humanity. And actually being willing to have your smile be enough. Like,
yeah,
just,
sure.
It's not that you have to limit it on that level, no. But it's like, can you let go of your ideas of what it looks like to be in service? And instead, can it be enough that you help someone across the road, or you give them a smile in the shop and maybe that brightens their day? Or like, can you
be humble enough
to
just have these small these interactions, these one? I've thought about this myself, this idea of why... this is my take on it. You know, in the New Testament, Jesus says, love your neighbor. And I thought that was quite an interesting viewpoint, because, you know, there's a big expansion. What does it mean to love your neighbor? What does it mean to love, you know, it's not just feel the feels. It's actually acting in accord with the best welfare of whoever. And what I found interesting about that is, and I think is often overlooked, it's that it's your neighbor.
Mm.
It's this idea that it's not like love the whole world, right? Take action, fix the whole world, take the whole world. You know, you're responsible for. And I see this a lot in our culture. Everyone's obsessed with like saving the world in whatever dimension. You know, big things, and actually, you know, in some sense, that could be at risk of a sort of a hubristic, egoic perspective.
Yeah, God complex a little bit.
Right, I'm here to save everyone and everything.
Yeah.
Well, can you first deal and, you know, be present to and treat those closest to you? Mm-hmm. With the utmost, or with to whatever degree of compassion and love you have, can you treat that person, your neighbor, the person right next to you, mm-hmm. not the person over on the other side of the world, as you say, not to exclude that,
if that's
available to you, by all means, but not to overlook the simple humility of every single interaction, as you say, the person you smile to, not giving someone the bird if they cut you off, letting someone out, you know, if you're driving down the road, you know, little small gestures of compassion and help and consideration and sensitivity to the other.
Yeah.
That, and it's so local and it's so immediate, and it's what we're really called to do, I think.
And it's what it's,
but it takes
called,
humility
it
to,
does.
To see that as valuable.
Yeah, because it's being called to each and every moment, and sometimes those moments are grand and have many people and Indeed. Big movements of things happening. But I think we can lose sight of the small in favor of the large. And in that, it's like we've decided that help has to look a certain way. Service has to look a certain way. I have to do great things. And actually, there can be a little bit of ego in that,
yeah.
of that sense of I have so much potential. I have the ability to change the world, which while may be true,
yeah.
it's putting the I at the center of all of that.
Right. Right.
Instead of, you know, in terms of religious terms, instead of God in the center of that, and in terms of spiritual, you know, the self in at the center of that, the true self, and you become in that way just the vehicle of grace. Then
there was something I quoted the other day on this subject to someone, and it was I'll see if I can find it. Give me one sec. So it was from Lord of the Rings, and Gandalf said it, and they were talking about the big powers of the world, the dark and the light and all that. And he said, some believe it is only great power that can hold evil in check, but it is not what I have found. It's the small everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keep the darkness at bay. Small acts of kindness and love.
Oh, I love that, yeah.
And I just love the humility of that,
yeah.
that approach. And but that's not to say those small acts turn out to be small, because a single act of kindness or a single act of harshness or you know, ill will, there's this idea that everything we do ripples into eternity.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of true and not true. There's this deep connection, and everything we do has immeasurable, the smallest gesture, the smallest thing we do or the smallest thing that happens has immeasurable effects across the infinity of time and space. It's just a fact.
Yeah. And yet, but not leaving behind the recognition that it's not our doing, truly. So there's the yes, it is, and not it indeed. To me.
But to be, you know, if we're talking about the impact of true kindness, true compassion, true love, it's often the smallest things, and it pulls us right back to our moment as well. Then, doesn't it? It's not about big international global. You know, efforts, blah, blah, blah. It brings us right back to our present moment. What is happening now? Not in some abstracted, removed from our experience ideas and grand gestures. It's right now. What is right now? Come back to this moment, this living present, which is effectively all there is.
Yeah.
And it's how we live here, how we inhabit this moment.
Yeah. And I think from that platform, this is where you become available.
Yeah.
Truly available.
Yeah.
To life.
And each other.
Yeah.
Which is just self anyway. We're all rooted, and we're all connected, and we're all of the same source. We are the one singular being. And that was the big insight for me that came in this wake of self-liberation, seeking my own freedom because out of necessity, and then getting to a point where that clarity is present and abiding, and then realizing that even though the nature of this being, this field of consciousness that I am, we are, is dreamlike, you can't simply dismiss the suffering of another.
No.
It just doesn't work that way. We feel it.
Yeah.
You can't go, oh, it's all a dream. That's not my lived reality.
No.
That's the compassion that and I think that's the nature of the sort of, let's say, the emergence of the Bodhisattva, for want of a better word, the emergence of that the loving kindness and the movement of loving kindness and the functioning of loving kindness, love, kindness, compassion, the movement of that, it informs actions, it informs perspective. Yeah. So far from being now, I'm done, I'm good.
Yes.
So long, suckers. Thanks for all the fish.
Yeah.
You'll actually feel that the meaningfulness of your own existence is in that. And you speak to that brokenheartedness, yeah, because you know we still live in witness to the suffering of others, and that suffering, yeah, it's not like you can do, it's not like it's for us to do anything necessarily about that. And yeah, so you have to live in witness to yeah, suffering.
And also I think it's like to not look at it in terms of just brokenheartedness as a bad thing, but openness.
Yeah, broken openness. Yeah.
And it's like where you are broken open, there's where you feel both the pleasure and the pain of it all. There's where you feel the beauty and the sorrow of it all. And actually, there's where you meet the other fully, because you meet yourself fully.
Yeah.
And it sort of leads me to, we were having a discussion, I don't know, a couple of days ago maybe, and it was about this, I mean we've had it many times before, but it just reminded me of, you know, talking about, regardless of the story of the suffering,
yeah,
there is the reality of the suffering, that suffering is.
Yes, so yeah, the principle I see is that, you know, if someone is reporting if someone's experienced suffering, they're experiencing suffering. Now, it's often the case that what they might, or what we might attribute that, yes, suffering to, might be
the causes. Yeah,
yeah, might be completely terribly misguided, because ultimately the causes are alienation from our true nature. But it might be, oh, it's this causing that. And, you know, so, but you can't discount that suffering as an experience.
Exactly.
And go, hey, that your suffering is just an illusion, and that doesn't work.
No, it's terribly unskilled, and actually, I would say cruel.
Yeah.
On some level, you know, it's I see some who go down that route, and you know.
But then it's really hard to, you know, see someone who's experiencing suffering.
Yeah.
And who's in a sit in whatever paradigm, whatever in resistance, accounting or for their suffering in all the wrong ways and seeking solutions to that suffering in all the wrong places. Is looking, mm-hmm, was that phrase, you know, looking for happiness in all the wrong places, yeah, looking for relief in all the wrong places, which, yeah, of course is the root of things like addiction and, you know, like the suffering, the reality of that suffering, because it's misunderstood what the nature and causes of that suffering, they'll go and perpetuate more of it, do the wrong things that cause more suffering. So it's like sowing the seeds of future suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So the suffering's real, but because of the, you know, this is why Buddhism, for example, is so much about wrong notions, mm-hmm, you know, which is to say, fundamental misunderstandings of what's going on, you know, yeah, the Dharma, as it's called in Buddhism, is really another word for how it is, the nature of reality.
Yeah.
So it's all about getting straight with the nature of reality, and it's our illusions, our delusions, our false notions are actually giving rise to our experience of suffering. But if we haven't got clarity on those causes, the nature of that, then we're just going to perpetuate our own suffering, and that's hard to watch.
It is,
but
it is
at the same time, the deeper sense is that we're all life itself is in a process of enlightening us,
yes,
and bringing us back home to our true nature in all the ways of the world, and nothing, yeah, is wasted.
Nothing is wasted. And there's deep, deep, deep compassion.
Yeah.
Because we can recognize how easy that comes about, how easy that fall into the delusion of lack of clarity,
yeah,
around the causing, the true causes of, yeah, suffering. There's great unending and deep compassion, yeah, for why that would be.
And I love this. There's this, it's interesting. it's there's a great the Lotus Sutra is you know a well regarded you know, one of the most well regarded Buddhist sutra, Mahayana sutras, and what it's full of parables. And I love the parable of the burning house. There's a there's a parable in there that's saying basically the fact that the sentient beings, let's say those who are still, you know, under the in the thrall of what you might say is delusion or illusion, are suffering and don't even know they're suffering. And so the parable is like that sentient beings are like children in a burning house, big burning house. And the house is on fire, and the kids are just there playing with their toys. And the father outside, who's the Buddha, is going, "Come out of the house is on fire." And the kids are like, "Yeah, whatever.
It's not on fire. It's I don't like, see the fire.
What's fire? Yeah. I don't know, whatever." And so the direct approach isn't enough, and they're oblivious to their own suffering and the fact that they'll continue to suffer and get even worse and worse. So that's the idea. And so what the Buddha does then is what the father does is say, "Hey kids, I've got this really excellent, I've got a big cart full of toys for each of you." And so they go, "Okay." And you know, and then they all come out of the house. So he kind of tricks them out of the house. And of course the carts are these, you know, the vehicles of the great vehicles of it turns out there's one, but it's the great vehicle by which the kids are saved from their perpetual suffering, which at that point they're not even quite aware of.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know why I'm pointing to that, but most people are not even aware of that suffering is occurring.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, that suffering becomes
untenable,
evident, untenable, and then start to seek for not just temporary relief from it, but a permanently uprooting the very nature, the possibility that there might be a way to permanently uproot the nature of that suffering.
And until they're open, ripe, and ready to that, it's only going to be temporary solutions.
Indeed.
And so that's the toy carts of like...
That's the kids. Those are the... Yeah.
Yeah, it's like where there's not that ripeness, all that is being sought is temporary relief solutions to suffering.
So the big cart is basically saying there's a permanent answer. There's the big payoff here.
But if not you only all are able to see that immediately.
No, and so that's been my part of my growth post awakening is to see that more deeply that only people come to this when they're ready to come to it.
Yeah.
You know, and I see it in my own experience, you know, with the certain teachings and certain, you know, aspects of this that I came to. Had I heard about them 5 or 10 or 15 years previously, I just wouldn't have heard it. So you probably did reject
some. I certainly did. Yeah, rejected teachings that I wasn't ready for, didn't hear.
You didn't register.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I do see it as a developmental process.
Or even more than just don't register, that's one possibility. Yeah. Another one is an actual attack on that because it actually hits on something. It starts to crumble a wall that isn't ready to be crumbled.
Oh, yeah,
yet.
Non-doership is
a great example of that.
Right.
Like I've had so many experiences of accidentally touching a wall that really doesn't want to be
suggesting
that
they might not be in control or they might not exist in the way that they think they do.
Yeah, that's a tender one. That's a particularly tender one. I try to be mindful of that particularly because it can be life-shattering for
but that can swing both ways, isn't it? I mean, so you know, on one hand, depends on where someone is when they're exposed to the idea of non-doership or, you know, which is complete radical lack of control of reality. Now, some people will hear that and, as you say, not just reject it, but attack the idea and really go on the on the offensive to defend the fact that the because it's talking about their own sense of control, to suggest that they're out of control. Absolutely devastating. And another type of person, you might go, hey, oh, what a relief, I'm not doing it, I don't have to
I would say that's a factor of ripeness. So I would say that what happens to one that's not ripe to hear that, they hear it in the head, and the head, as they hear in the ego, and the ego is like, oh no, I'm in control, I can't give up my control, I'll die otherwise. That's the root of the voice there. And so that's the head hearing that, and that's the ego hearing that. But however, someone that's ripe to hearing that, they're hearing that from the heart. They're hearing that from the true self. And the true self goes, yes. There's the liberation. They feel only liberation in that. They sense the truth of it. They sense the reality, and they sense the calling of surrender to the heart. And so it's delightful for those that are ready to hear that. They hear that with such openness, with such
relief. It's very interesting. You know, I always bear in mind that. You know, although there's a universal, there's universal themes in these this teaching, but as Maharshi would say, knowledge is different in different states of consciousness. So you'll say the same thing, and depending on where the individual is, they'll hear it differently. And that's all right, you know. And actually, sometimes that's not just about rejecting at one level and accepting at another. Sometimes it's like, there's some really beautiful pointings, and knowledge is the case that, like, you return, it'll actually touch you quite deeply. It'll point to something really profound in your own experience and really open yourself up to some realization. And then, you know, come back round to it, you know, later on. And not only is it still true, but another layer opens up, another blossoming of that thing touches you. So that's really, you kind of cycle around to it.
And I think, you know, as someone who sits with people, what I've come to see over all of these years is, like, where I started out with all of this was this sense of like, I need to get someone to somewhere. And I actually... really, as I've matured in this, what I see is that it's much more about the appreciation and the love of the process that the individual is going through, the unfoldment at exactly the right pace for them. And what's so beautiful in that is all sense of my knowing is completely, like, I don't know what the word is, dissolved into the unknowing of it all. And what you're left with is this purity of to bear witness to. And I think that that's really something really beautiful, because it's like bearing witness to a flower, a garden flowering. And in that, it's really quite magical to see how life is so mysteriously and perfectly unfolding for each individual, each expression of consciousness. And I think that's just a natural byproduct of finding yourself further and further seated into the heart. There's more and more of a love of life as it is expressed, and less of designs on that life.
Yeah, and trusting that it is that the best intelligence of how this thing is unfolding is life itself. It's doing it's doing the work, and we just kind of got to get out of the way of it. And, you know, and again, making ourselves, you know, finding ourselves as this sort of this boundless expanse in which life can, you know, express, and certainly through working with people who come and providing that kind of that spaciousness.
I would say, you know, talking about why people teach, it's part of what has been really beautiful for me is actually stepping into this role. I don't call myself a teacher, more a mentor, but broadly speaking, it's, you know, people use terminologies differently, but stepping into this role has been one of my greatest teachers as well.
Right.
And it's like every day, every time I meet someone, every moment almost, it's really like life further opening me up, further guiding me into insight. And it just so happened to come through this role that a lot of my sort of lessons have come in the role as well.
Yeah, interesting.
And so just as much as, you know, someone may get out of meeting me, I feel the same way,
right,
of getting, you know, some deep growth and insight and wisdom from just being present to meeting the other. Right. And so for me, that's another thing of maybe why people find themselves teaching, is because that's their next lesson. That's their next unfoldment, is, you know, they say, what's that thing of like if you really want to learn something, teach. If you really want to see how much you've learned, teach. And that's, you know, I'm not talking intellectually here. I'm talking experientially. But it's like, you know, it's been so humbling, such a growth phase for me personally, to be in that interaction with the other in that manner, to hold space for them. It asks of me to do my own work constantly, constantly. I mean, I joke that I'm not the same person I was last week, but I really mean that when I say that. And that to me has only been intensified by meeting with all the people that I meet with, that sort of really deeply steeped in that that life ever asking you to meet yourself and meet them deeper and deeper in each moment. Like anything that is left over, anything that needs to be seen, there's no hiding from any of it.
Beautiful.
And more so when you're in that kind of role, I would say. It's challenging as well, because you can't hide from any of your crap. Not at all. Even when you want to sometimes.
Okay, let's wrap it up for today. That was beautiful. Right. Okay, so thanks for listening, everyone. Please, if you feel to, please like, please subscribe, please share. It all helps.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
Bye for now.